All right.
Good morning. Are we on? Thank you for being here. We're still getting a few things settled, but I'd like to get us started because we have an ambitious agenda this morning. I'm Lori Halverson. I'm co-chairing this healthcare cost study group with Representative Tara Mack, and I want to thank everybody for being here. And this is our first meeting. It's supposed to be our second, which is why our agenda is so full. But it's a nice balmy 20 degrees warmer than it was the last time we all tried to gather. And so we all were able to start our cars and make it in this morning. Our next meeting, just as an FYI, is February 11th, so I hope that's on your calendars as well. This meeting is coming about because of a number of conversations I've had with members, with stakeholders, about the healthcare discussions we're having here at the Capitol and discussions that are happening at the state level, at the local level, the federal level about healthcare. And it's very clear that cost is going to be a big hurdle that we're going to be facing as a state. And I thought it would behoove us to get together as policymakers and stakeholders and start studying this particular issue so that we can come together. We've got about six meetings that we've sketched out. The first two are scheduled to look at cost drivers, to look at care models, to look at payment models, and to look at opportunities for savings in the system, and also to recognize the challenges that we're going to be seeing as healthcare, as we continue to deliver healthcare to an ever-changing population. And so with that, I talked to my colleague, Representative Mack, because I think it's important that we make this a bipartisan process. I think that it's important that we make this a visioning process. So in terms of outcomes of these six meetings that we have, what I anticipate is that we will be able to get together as policymakers and stakeholders and start talking about visioning, not specific policy recommendations, but what do we want in Minnesota's healthcare system in the next 20 years? How much should it cost, and how are we going to pay for it? And who's going to pay for it? And so all those questions are big questions that are facing us as policymakers and stakeholders. And in the great Minnesota tradition, we've come together historically to solve these kind of problems. And that's what I'm hoping we get started here today. And so welcome. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Representative Mack, and she can offer her two cents, and we will hear from our presenters.
Well, thank you for coming out today, everyone. And I just want to thank Representative Halverson. She really spearheaded this whole idea and asked me to come alongside, which I was honored to do. I think it's an important conversation. And so I will be brief. My hopes in these conversations is, one, that we all continue to get an education in what I always say is a mile-long issue, that is health and human services, of which I feel like I understand maybe the first 100 feet on a day-to-day basis in the conversations that we have and the complicated issues that we're constantly facing. But I hope through these conversations that we can all kind of take off some of our preconceived ideas of what we think might be cost drivers, what we hope are the cost drivers, and be able to just really kind of take head on what the facts are showing us, what the statistics are showing us. I know a lot of the stakeholder groups from my conversations over the past few years and past few months are a few steps ahead of us in some areas in terms of trying to bend the cost curve, trying to do things more innovatively. So I'm really excited to hear about that and see what we can adopt as policymakers, see how we can come alongside and get out of the way of the stakeholders and the folks that are out with their boots on the ground kind of implementing some of these issues, trying to turn the tide in what we're seeing in the cost drivers. So with that, I look forward to getting started in the conversation. And one thing I was going to ask, I can't remember, Representative Halverson, if we want to take questions of the presenters as we go or at the end. I know that was one question some of my colleagues on this side had, is just we address that maybe before we start with the presenters.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for being here, colleagues, and I want folks to know there's folks joining us on the phone as well. Since we're not in session, the people who are traversing the state don't have to drive down here to get the information that's going to be presented. And I believe that it would be helpful, maybe the presenters can help guide us in terms of what would be easiest for them, but I think that if we get to hear from folks and then have questions at the end for each presenter, that might be the most efficient way to do things. So, if that's all right.
Sounds great.
And I think that we are ready to begin. I also would like to invite Susan Brower, Minnesota State Demographer, to come and join us, if she would, and let folks know that the theme of this meeting, we are talking about where we're at today. We're trying to get a picture of what our landscape is as Minnesotans and where we're actually spending money within our healthcare system. And so that's the framework for today. And I hope people will give us a little bit of leeway in terms of timing. I know that we're getting a little bit of a late start. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Ms. Brower.
Thank you. My name is Susan Brower. I'm the Minnesota State Demographer, and I work in the Department of Administration. I've been asked to talk today about the general demographic trends that we can anticipate in the next several decades, the next few decades. I guess in the past we've talked about demographic currents, but that is a bit of an understatement, I think, when we think about the aging trend that I'll be showing you. I'm just hoping to give you today a general sense of what we can anticipate for the population and how the population changes have patterns with respect to health and healthcare costs. So with that, let's just get a sense of what the aging trend looks like. We're looking here at 100 years of aging spread out over these 100 years of aging spread out over the axis here. So that in 1950s, we had 85,000 additional older adults than we did in the decade before that. 55,000 in the 60s. We've been marching along, growing at a relatively steady pace, so that we have each decade roughly the same number, between 50 and 100,000 more older adults than we did in the decade prior. This decade, we will add close to 300,000 older adults, people who are 65 plus, to Minnesota. And in the 20s, we'll see 300,000 more. So if you compare this to the past decades, this decade we'll see roughly four kind of normal decades of growth in the older adult population. In the 20s, we'll see on top of that five decades of growth compressed into one decade. So this is a tremendous change that is compressed into a very short period of time. When we make these projections, it's a pretty straightforward method of doing so. We know how many people are living here in Minnesota right now. We know how old they are, and so we know with a great deal of certainty, a fair amount of certainty, when they will cross over that 65-year-old age mark, which is traditionally the age that we look at in terms of retirement, in terms of health, and it's really when changes in health status and disability start happening across the life course. So this just should give you a sense of what we look like as a state. The bars going out to the left and the right are five-year age groups. And if you think of this population pyramid that we're looking at here as an escalator, so that every 5 years everyone's moving up a bar, every 5 years everyone's moving up a bar, you can see that that large cohort who are now in their 50 to 60-year-old age range is just set to move above that 65-year-old age mark in the next decade or two. So we'll be seeing that very, very rapid, very soon, very rapid changes. To give you just another view of it in terms of what the curve looks like in aging late over future biennia, over the next 11 or so biennia, we're going to see increasing numbers of older adults will start feeling that kind of mounting pressure in terms of demand for services. One of the reasons why that is there's a fairly predictable pattern to healthcare costs by age. So that you can see here, 96% of adults who are 65 and older typically have some kind of a medical expense that grows up from, you know, the mid-adult ages, 18 to 44, where it's only 76%. The cost of healthcare per person in those age groups is also higher as you get into the older ages. And there's a similar pattern for disability. We see for every 10 years of life, roughly a 20% increase in prevalence in disability. Here, disability is measured as serious difficulty in one of four basic areas of functioning: vision, hearing, ambulation, or cognition. So you can see in the 65 to 74-year-old age range, about one in five of those adults have a disability, one or more disabilities. That grows to roughly 40% over the next 10 years, and by the time you're 85 plus, on average, 60% of those folks have a disability. So we've heard a lot recently about improvements in life expectancy and in healthy disability-free years, and that has been occurring, certainly. But what we're seeing is that there's been small increases relative to what the overall patterning is. So this is really a certain pattern that we're likely to all experience, even though there has been some improvements over time. Here in Minnesota, we are fairly healthy compared to the rest of the nation. At age 65, we can expect to live roughly 20 more years. About 15 of those are healthy years. Am I doom and gloom this morning? Everyone's getting a little more stiff. This is the reality of aging, which I am laying out for you today. The need for long-term care, because of this increase in the need for medical care, for health care, because of increases in disability, the need for long-term care grows with age. So whether or not you're in an institution or not, altogether, roughly 70% of older adults, 85 plus, require some form of long-term care, whether it's in a nursing home or at home. The Department of Human Services in 2010 asked Minnesota baby boomers what were their plans for long-term care. How did they expect to finance long-term care? And 32% answered that they didn't know, and 18% said that they would rely on a government program. So of that huge increase in the aging trend that we just saw, in the next two decades, roughly half of those potentially are not prepared financially for the long-term care that they will likely eventually need. There have been efforts, Own Your Future in particular is one that is looking to develop products around long-term care insurance. So that, you know, this is a need that is being addressed, but it is a very real need that will be coming up shortly. If we look at the state's general fund, the main areas of the budget relate to education, health, and human services. And if we look at that 31% of the general fund that is health and human services, roughly half of that, 16%, is related to medical assistance expenditures for the elderly and disabled. So those are the areas of the budget that we're talking about in terms of the general fund that could be impacted by this aging trend. For the first time in history, we'll see older adults, more older adults than school-aged children by 2020. And so you can see a very rapid increase that we've been talking about in the 65-plus population between 2010 and 2030. It will cross that K-12 group of people, young people, by 2020. And what I like to bring people's attention to with this projection that we've made is that the group of children who will be demanding, I don't know if they demand education, but who will be who will be in our K-12 system will continue to grow slowly as it has in the past, at the same time that these other needs are accelerating. So there was a study that was done, the Budget Trend Study Commission looked at some of the implications if healthcare costs to the state were to continue to grow at the same rate that it had at the time of the study, which was 2008, and if revenue were to continue to grow at the same rate, roughly the same rate, 4%, what would that mean to all areas of the budget outside of healthcare? So they just projected out annual growth each year between 2008 and 2033, just to give a sense of what the impact would be on the other areas of the budget, and found that there would be very little room for growth outside of any outside of the healthcare growth. So there would be education would be constrained. All other areas of the budget would be constrained if healthcare costs were to continue to grow at the same rate. Now, since 2008, we have seen lower healthcare costs, and I think we're going to hear more about that from others today. But there's been deflation, so there have been changes to that 8.5%, likely since 2008 when the study was done. But that projection did not take into account increased enrollments that we're likely to see due to our age structure. So there's some uncertainty there in just exactly how this estimate will play out, but it should give you a sense of just how important healthcare is to the rest of the entire budget. So this is my sobering recap slide. Age brings a predictable pattern, higher healthcare costs, more long-term care needs, higher levels of disability, and these are likely, at least in terms of the general fund, to impact basic care, elderly waivers, and nursing facilities, long-term care. First, my second and final demographic trend that I just wanted to briefly outline for you was the increase in diversity in Minnesota and how that might be related to healthcare costs, health in general, going forward. Our fastest growing groups in Minnesota are populations of color, particularly Asian residents, Black or African American, Hispanic or Latino are growing the fastest. And so we can anticipate that most of the growth going forward, as we've seen even in the last decade, can be attributed to populations of color. It just it has to do both with migration but also with our age structure. And when we look at rates of mortality, there are big differences in terms of across race. So we look at mortality typically because it's a pretty good overall population measure of overall health. And it kind of gives us a sense of how the distribution of health falls within the state. And you can see that there are very high rates of mortality, in particular for American Indian Minnesotans, for U.S.-born African Americans, or Blacks, and much lower rates for other groups, white, non-Hispanic residents included. We've seen an increase in poverty over the last decade. In the very last year, between 2011 and 2012, for which we have data, we've seen a slight decline for the first time, but the overall trend across the state has been toward more poverty. And when we look at those differences by race, there are tremendous differences, so that almost 40% of Black Minnesotans have incomes below the federal poverty threshold, roughly the same for American Indian Minnesotans, and these rates have the gap between our racial groups and our white Minnesotans has remained fairly steady throughout the period that's studied here. This also plays out in terms of disability. We see a lot of the same patterning, so that we see high rates of disability among the groups who have lower socioeconomic status. And I just point this out to say that this is a complicated process, a causal process to disentangle what exactly is race, what exactly is income. But we know overall that we're seeing increasing diversity, and that will continue. And we know that we're seeing higher rates of poverty in general, particularly among our populations of color. And this is likely to have patterning toward health that mirrors the pattern that we see by race, by socioeconomic status. So we can anticipate growth in this population. Again, it's not a straightforward cause between, you know, causal arrow between race and health outcome, but we certainly know that our fastest growing populations and historically have been those at greatest risk for poorer health. And with that, do you have any questions for me? I deliver it in such a cheery voice, don't I?
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Are there any questions, or is everybody just digesting everything?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Ms. Brower, my first question is, do you enjoy your job?
I knew I was sounding too cheery. I do enjoy my job.
Well, thank you very much. This is incredibly informative, I think, on a whole number of fronts. And I guess one of the clarifications that I would ask, you know, if you could briefly speak to is, are you seeing any trend for the aging to stay in the labor workforce longer?
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative. We are seeing that. Initially, around the recession, we saw a lowering of the retirement age, but now that we're coming out of that, we are seeing that older adults are staying in the labor force a bit longer. It's not a huge transformation overall when we look at the whole labor force. It doesn't have tremendously big impacts because the labor force is just so large. But we are seeing a slight uptick in labor force participation rates among older adults, yes.
Ms. Brower, do you find that would be, if there's any indication, is that due to the desire for income replacement or as a function of needing to secure additional health benefits?
I have not seen a specific study that has asked people what their motivation has been. So I can only speculate that it would likely be both. We know that there has been loss of income to folks at the older ages in Minnesota and across the U.S., and so there's certainly a need for health insurance in addition to just that income. But we also know that there have been increases in disability for years, that baby boomers are particularly attached to the workplace and want to work. Many of them want to work as long as they can, as long as they're healthy and enjoying their work. So I can't say specifically which pull outweighs the other, but it's all in the mix there, I believe. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. This was very informative, and appreciate that. And for members who are joining us on the phone, I know that we'll have these handouts and presentations available electronically. Ms. Montgomery is going to help us facilitate that, so we can all have these helpful statistics. Next, we are going to hear from Stefan Gildemeister, the state health economist. Thank you so much for being here.
Good
Welcome.
Morning. It's always tough to follow the demographer because she has the best slides. but maybe I can add some optimism to the picture and compensate. Thank you for having me today, this morning. I appreciate the invitation. For the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the Health Economics Program in the Department of Health. And I have 20 minutes for what probably is more of a four-hour discussion, but I'll try to keep it to the 20 minutes that you've made available. What I want to do is tell you just a little bit about the Health Economics Program, take a step back and maybe touch on some definitions that I think might be helpful in your ongoing deliberations, and then provide you some statistics and data about Minnesota that I think you will find of interest. So the Health Economics Program in the Department of Health is a research shop that conducts applied analysis to supply you with information for the policy development process. We monitor changes in the healthcare marketplace to understand healthcare costs, access to insurance coverage and healthcare, and quality of care delivery. And we also have a role in implementing aspects of health reform activities that relate to transparency and cost and quality. So cost, what I'm trying to say is cost is sort of up our alley. So this is the step back that I thought might be helpful to take. I find myself often when I talk about healthcare's costs and healthcare spending to sort of intermix terms that are related but not that are somewhat distinct. So I thought so that I don't confuse you, maybe provide some very brief definitions. So when we talk about costs, we can talk about a bunch of things, but in its very basic form, I think costs really in the top left corner is what economists might call the cost of production. What does it cost to deliver a colonoscopy? The staff time, the education that is built into that, the fixed costs related to the healthcare facility. So that's in its most basic form the cost of healthcare. Price differs from that, of course, because we built into price a reasonable profit. We built into it contractual negotiations. We built into it perhaps a reputational gain. So price is different from cost. And then if we multiply price times utilization times quantity, we essentially, for this first example, we essentially get the spending per procedure. So if we're interested in asking how much does the U.S. or how much does Minnesota spend on colonoscopies, the example that often is used to sort of highlight why healthcare costs are high in the U.S., you know, we would multiply price for colonoscopies across various payers times utilization. And then if we take other services and procedures and sort of go through the same exercise, that's how we end up then with total healthcare spending. So as you think about triggers for cost containment or for opportunities for delivery system reform, you might want to ask, are we interested in affecting the effectiveness of the healthcare system in producing a good? Or are we interested in reforming the payment system so that the price signals work in the way in which they're intended? Or are we thinking about sort of utilization? Are we using too much of one service, or do we have a mix of services that is responsible for producing healthcare spending growth beyond what we think is acceptable? And with that, let me get into the data and some charts. So in 2011, the latest year for which we have data, Minnesota spent $38.2 billion on healthcare. That is, compared to the previous year, a very marginal growth of about 2%. Marginal because on an average annual basis, the year-over-year cost growth was about 7.7%. So during the recession and after, through the slow recovery, healthcare costs have been rising quite slowly. Now some are celebrating this as a potential structural change in the in the healthcare economy that maybe is the beginning of reading off the benefits of some of the reforms we've put in place. I think some of that is definitely going on, but to the extent that we in Minnesota have been on the forefront of that work, but that the spending trends nationally are similar, where healthcare costs growth is climbing more slowly. I think there are probably a lot of arguments to still say, well, it's the recession and the loss of wealth and perhaps some of the health insurance products that shift some greater responsibility to consumers that help constrain healthcare spending, and not so much the success of health reforms. So where are we spending the $38.2 billion on, or where did we spend them on in 2011? About 30% of that expenditure occurs for hospital care, 20% on in inpatient settings, and 14% in outpatient settings. Physician services account for about 20% of spending, and long-term care, the category that we definitely expect to grow with the aging population, the point that the demographer set up, is currently at about 15% of healthcare spending. Drugs is always sort of a topic that we worry about, because we've had many years of fast growth in prescription drugs. That's been reversed in Minnesota for the last couple of years. But it remains still a small share of overall spending at less than 10%. How do we finance this care? The largest source of financing, albeit a declining proportion, is private health insurance spending. So spending through private coverage that we hold is the primary source of financing for healthcare. I think in Minnesota that is somewhat unique, because we still enjoy higher rates of coverage, and those higher rates of coverage largely are generated through higher rates of employer-based coverage. So private insurance, anyway, is still the major funding source in Minnesota. Medical assistance, the Medicaid program, funds about 20% of care, and Medicare, the program for the elderly and disabled, about the same amount, 19%. So out of pocket, we contribute to the financing of healthcare about 12% of the total pie of healthcare spending. Minnesota Care is built in here down on the right-hand side, and other public spending, and then the other private spending category includes things like workers' compensation. So here I'll try some optimism. Compared to the national context, healthcare spending in Minnesota, while being high, is low. In 2011, healthcare spending added up to about $7,000 per person in the state, compared to more than $8,000 at the national level. We also spend less of our economy on healthcare in the state, about 13.6% in 2011, compared to almost 17% nationwide. But we should ask ourselves, and we need to continue to ask ourselves, whether the trends that we're currently observing in healthcare spending and healthcare spending growth, whether those trends are sustainable. So what this chart shows is the trends of healthcare costs cumulatively over the past 12 years compared to sort of other economic indicators that we tend to follow. The economy or the state product, per capita income, average weekly wage, consumer prices. And what this chart displays is that healthcare costs have been growing at about twice the rate of some of these other factors. So while our income, average weekly wages grew by somewhat over 20%, healthcare costs grew by about 106% over this period. So what this means, of course, is over time we are contributing a bigger share of our budgets to its healthcare spending. We do that as individuals, we do that as government, and to the extent that businesses cannot pass on the cost to their employees, it also comes out of businesses' budgets. And I guess I'm losing my optimism here, because if the trend continues, we would expect, and the relationship between healthcare costs, demographics, and economic trends, if those relationship continues, healthcare costs in the next 10 years would more than double to about 82%. $82 billion in 2021, consuming about 18% of the state's economy. So, what are the cost drivers? You know, there's demographic change that we've heard some about, and that sort of includes both the aging of the population, but also perhaps sort of a change in the health status, population getting sicker. Price and utilization are key factors of it. Service mix, how we are choosing between, surgery and physical therapy visits. Wasteful care is perhaps not so much a cost driver as a cost built into the system that we ought to think about probably. And then as we think about concern about healthcare costs and healthcare cost growth, I think we also should recognize that the healthcare is a productive contributor to Minnesota's economy, so that as we think about shrinking one sector, there is employment and economic opportunity built into that sector. So to take the spending trends and decompose them into various categories is pretty tricky, and it requires a lot of very detailed data that we don't have access to in Minnesota. But what I'm showing you here is an analysis at the national level done by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that sort of do a comparable analysis to what we're doing in Minnesota on annual healthcare expenditure trends. And like us, they put a report out every year, and in their analysis, and I think there are not a lot of reasons to believe that the underlying factors are very different in Minnesota, but in their analysis, they are finding that the majority, the largest driver in healthcare costs, are medical prices. So prices accounted in 2012 for about almost 60% of the change in healthcare spending. So 60% or, trying to pull up a number here, or, you know, about of the 3.2% growth, about 1.8 percentage points of overall spending. Age and gender play still a relatively minor role in that analysis, accounting for about 18% of year-over-year spending growth. And then the non-price factors, to the extent that they can really be carved out from the price factors really well, and that's where some of the service mix is contained, then accounts for about 23.5% of growth in spending in 2012. And these patterns have remained fairly stable over the past 10 years or so, but watching them over time to see whether the demographic changes or the changes in the healthcare economy sort of shifts these relationships, I think, is an important indicator of how to think about healthcare cost growth. So there are many folks out there studying the drivers of healthcare spending. I think we in the U.S. have gone through phases of being worried about healthcare cost growth. At times, we're worried about the quality of the delivery system. So I think we're now in a phase we're actually looking at both of these questions at the same time, and I think it's a very healthy place to be. So there's a lot of research that tries to dig into understanding what drives healthcare spending and also to imagine then what the opportunities are for constraining spending or spending more wisely. Scientific uncertainty or the fact that we still don't know a huge amount about some aspects of medical care, what works, what doesn't work. I have a little bit of a cold today, and nothing helps apparently. perverse economic and practice incentives, so sort of the idea that our payment systems right now promote greater use of services rather than focus of services that are of high value. System fragmentation, I think that's particularly important for people with chronic diseases and people sort of who have complex healthcare needs. There are lots of opportunities in looking for prevention and maintaining health rather than treating illness at the back end. Lack of transparency in cost, quality, and outcomes. I think consumers, but also employers and purchasers are still looking for better information on how to assess high value in healthcare. An aspect that we are much more familiar with, of course, in other areas of our economy, because we have a much better sense. And I don't often compare healthcare to buying a car, but sometimes it's convenient. It's much more easy to assess the value of a car than it is to assess the value of a healthcare service. Still, changes in population's health status. I think this speaks to changes in chronic disease, increasing rates of obesity, lack of physical activity. Patient engagement is a really important aspect, both on the side of patients being involved in staying healthy, but also with regard to their being involved in making healthcare decisions. There is a lot of, as far as the literature is concerned, there's a lot of guessing what people want. Patients do what they think physicians want them to do, and physicians recommend what they think patients want to have done, and there's not really a very good overlap, particularly when it comes to very, very critical questions of surgery. And then underinvestment in population health and public health is really a critical driver in cost, because it doesn't help us to counter the trends in health status that we otherwise are observing. So taking everything of this, taking this together, the spending drivers in the healthcare system result in us spending much more on high-tech treatment of care services than is probably necessary, so much so that some economic research shows that technology drives between 38% and 65% of spending growth, so a significant part of spending. I wanted to touch on waste for just a moment, not so much because I believe or because there's evidence that it contributes to growth, but more so because it's built into the system as a cost that we probably could forego. you know, I remember talking about waste 10 years or so ago, and Representative Huntley will remember that the task force, the transformation task force, talked about it, and we sort of whispered that it was about 30%, and it seemed crazy high. But I think since then, much more research has been conducted, and the 30% looks pretty right on. But let's assume that in Minnesota, we, because of the investments we've made in IT, health IT, because of the fact that we're operating in a nonprofit, largely in a nonprofit environment, the fact that we are farther ahead on transparency, on cost and quality, let's assume waste is much more narrow than it might be for the nation overall. Let's say it's just 10% of our healthcare spending. Well, that's still $4 billion in 2011. So something to think about. The opportunities there lie in, again, payment reform, in thinking through administrative complexity, in asking what care is right, both in terms of avoiding overtreatment and compensating for undertreatment. And I'm coming to the end of my presentation, and I promise this is my second to last slide, but it's my favorite slide. And I'll walk you through it because I think it's really it really has some important lessons built into it. What this chart shows is that healthcare spending in the U.S. is very concentrated among a small share of the population. So how does that work? On the left side, as you move up the left axis, we cumulatively measure healthcare spending. So the higher we get, the more healthcare spending we account for. On the horizontal axis, we line up the population by their relative contribution to healthcare costs, with at least with people consuming consuming very little care on the left side, and people consuming a lot of care spending a lot of healthcare costs on the right side. So there are three figures, maybe there are three numbers that are worth to remember and to sort of digest. The first is here on the left side. About 15.4% of the population consume really no healthcare costs, or consume no healthcare. They account for zero healthcare spending. We don't know whether that's appropriate or not. Some of them probably should have some preventive care, but nevertheless, a significant portion of the population accounts for no healthcare spending at all. Now, if we move to the right and read the chart from the right-hand side, the population with the highest healthcare needs, the 1% of the population with the highest healthcare needs, accounts for the difference between 78 and 100%. So 21.8% of total healthcare spending. So 1% of our Minnesotans. This is a national chart, I should say, but again, there is no evidence to suggest this should be different in Minnesota. 1% of the population is responsible for 21.8% of spending, likely because they have very complex healthcare needs, likely because they not because they like the healthcare system so much, but because they have need for some of the finest and most complex care that is out there. And then if you slide down that graph to the left to 5% of the population, well, almost 50% of spending is accounted for by 5% of the population. So we could spend a lot of time thinking about the least costly 50% and sort of refining how we make them contribute to healthcare. But I would argue this data seems to suggest there is a lot of opportunity at the right-hand side. And a lot of healthcare reform is happening on the right-hand side, with care coordination, with looking at preventable readmissions and those kind of things. And I think Dr. Epstein will probably touch on that a little bit. So let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Healthcare spending contributes 13% of the economy, so something to keep in mind. Hospital care accounts for 5%, physician spending about 2%. and healthcare employees make up about 12% of Minnesota's employees. And perhaps a little known fact, during the recession, healthcare was the only industry that actually saw saw employment growth when the rest of the economy did very poorly, or actually contracted as it did in 2009 and 2010. But I leave it up to you to sort of think about which side of the coin we should be looking at with that kind of question. We have a lot more information online if you're interested in this work. We also have some of this data is drawn from 2011 analysis. We're preparing to update some of this through a survey, hopefully that we're releasing in February, so much more newer data to come, but also let us know if you have any questions.
Thank you very much. And I think that this really speaks to the fact that we're providing a very quick and brief and broad look at things, and just so that folks know that we'll have opportunities, we can keep talking about the opportunities to drill down into some of the finer points that you brought forward, and including, I know that we've talked about having meetings that include things like care coordination and prevention. So we'll be looking at some of those things as well, just so folks know as we move forward. Any questions? Yes, Representative Rowe.
A couple of quick questions. Thank you, Madam Chair. To Mr. Geldemeister, a little bit, looking through your slides and looking at the study looking at potential waste in the Minnesota healthcare system, you know, it's interesting that in the slide before that we talked about, you talked about system fragmentation as a potential cost driver, and then, you know, kind of in that small area looking at the waste, we look at, you know, and failures in care coordination. And wondering what your thoughts are and what your concerns are around looking at Minnesota specifically and how the Minnesota Medical Records Act kind of inhibits some care coordination, especially if you're going from system to system. I always use the example, you have the guy that goes to his GP with a hurt knee, maybe gets a scan of an x-ray or a scan, gets referred to a specialist. They don't have that information, so they end up repeating the test. Then they're going to get referred for surgery, perhaps get another diagnostic scan from the surgical group, and then the procedure done. And so you look at that type of duplication and replication. I mean, I have experiences like that within my own healthcare. At least 15 years ago, I was on the far 1% driving the cost. I don't drive the cost now. I'm good now. So I'm wondering if there's opportunities within Minnesota. I know that's a lot of the statistical information's national information that we've tried to evaluate specifically for our state. But I'm wondering what the opportunities are in changing some of our systemic approaches around limiting the sharing of information, even within a health system, that can drive some of that duplicative testing and procedures that can drive healthcare costs. I'm just wondering if you've had thoughts about that or could comment.
Well, maybe two thoughts. I think you're exactly right to say that fragmentation both has a human cost and also a sort of a dollar cost associated with it. I'm not sure that I'm too much of an expert of the Health Records Act, but suffice it to say that it's probably, that it is important, and providers speak about the importance of the ability of information to flow among providers so that they can assist in the process of delivering care. I think this will continue to be important, or even more important, as we work on evolving models such as accountable care organizations. So there, I think there is a financial incentive for providers to understand the patient's experience between times that they saw them directly. Mm-hmm. Was the patient admitted to another hospital? Why did that happen? Where did the system go wrong? What did we miss in the process? So that system improvement can happen. So I would absolutely agree to say that to improve the coordination of healthcare definitely requires data to be able to transmit safely and securely between providers. But also, I think when we talk about care coordination, we also need to increasingly recognize that we need to have that we need to involve service providers outside of the plain the medical environment. So particularly when we talk about social services and mental health providers, that integration, I think that we public health. That integration that currently doesn't exist is something that both the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health are working on through the State Innovation Model Grant with the support of stakeholder groups and the industry. So there are great opportunities there both to understand how to make this work better and what is needed and how to involve the patient in the process.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On your slide 6, I guess the comment that I would make is it's appropriate to consider where our healthcare dollars went, but I mean even more curious in terms of the velocity of each one of those pieces in terms of at what pace is each one of those growing?
Mm-hmm.
And as a, I guess, a corollary to that, if there, and this might be something for the demographer or well to speak to at a later date, not now, but to say if there's any attribution to immigration and to minority groups that favor certain areas of healthcare more than others, and if it is based upon cultural mores or attribution in terms of what they've view as being appropriate or not appropriate, maybe it's language barriers, and I don't expect you to speak to that, but more on just for the velocity of each one of those pie pieces and where you would say our attention should be focused.
You know, I don't have the data in front of me, but my recollection is that so far the pieces have not been moving a ton. So the pie has been increasing, of course. But the proportions have remained fairly stable over time. But I'm happy to, Madam Chair, to share with the committee some sort of historical analysis. To your second question, we do, and some of my colleagues have done this work and are sort of putting it together for an issue paper. I'm happy to share that too when that's ready. We do have the ability to estimate the percent of the population that is sort of admitted in, for instance, or that is seen in an emergency room when for care that really wasn't that acute. So we can look at some of that data to understand to what extent the entrance into the healthcare system is working well or not, and how that differs across population groups. I don't think we can do it by race and ethnicity, but we can probably do it by some other demographic factors. Also, what we're able to do and what we've done in the past is sort of to ask, and that we've done by race and ethnicity, to ask what's the usual, what percent of the population have a usual source of care, so have a provider that they go to for a typical healthcare problem. And what you find there is somewhat predictable that the uninsured generally have a lower rate of having a usual source of care, and further that they articulate their usual source of care as being an emergency room, which is probably not the most efficient place to access health care. So I think as we consider implementation of the ACA with a lot of more people entering the healthcare system, I think we need to really recognize that that the healthcare system needs to play a role in educating patients on healthcare, sort of health literacy, both in how we access care and how we use the healthcare system in a way that is efficient and serves patients the best.
Albright, and I want to be sure that we're being cognizant of time as well.
I'll be brief. I'm just going to move to your slide number 15. I find this a very compelling slide, just as you mentioned as well, but maybe for different reasons. And I think that it's been well publicized and well known that as you get older, you tend to consume a greater percentage per capita, per se, of the healthcare dollars. But I find it interesting or intriguing that that overlay was not put on this slide. And I'm wondering if you can speak to why that is, and it maybe reverts back to my earlier question. Is it based upon the demographics and the cultural barriers that people face? And or is it a function of where is that cost being borne by? Is it being borne by private insurance in the later years? Or the higher percentage consumption, or is it borne by public assistance?
Madam Chair, Representative, so really good point. So it would be really useful to look at the correlation of healthcare costs and or healthcare spending and age. And I think what you would see is what you would expect that with age, healthcare spending increases. As to the question. Does the payment mechanism contribute to healthcare, to the volume of healthcare cost, or how much both an individual consumes and how much we pay for that cost? I think that's a very complex question, and I'm not sure that I have a great answer ready for you right now. I think the demographer just pointed out that. Even absent, even if we ignore insurance coverage or type of insurance coverage for a moment, there is a pattern that healthcare complexity, healthcare needs increase with age. So, how the fact plays in that somebody is on Medicare on private coverage, I think is something we'd have to think about a little bit more. What we do know is that once people enter the Medicare program, there typically is sort of a little bit of a pent up demand. Where the range of services available and the affordability of the services by design are sort of creating that greater demand in healthcare. I think what we ought to think about is how to push that pent up demand further upstream, both in terms of age, but also in terms of where the care is consumed. So instead of having hospital care or complex surgery, think about preventive care in earlier years to delay the onset of disease or diminish the extent of it. So I think there are definitely opportunities there, but we can look at some more information about the relationship of income and spending. That was a good point. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. This was fascinating. And next, I'll invite Nancy Nelson, Chief Actuary from Blue Cross and Blue Shield, to come down. Thank you very much for being here. Welcome.
Good morning. Nelson. And, Madam Chairman, do you know, is the presentation able to be projected or not?
Is her presentation loaded?
I didn't load it.
Did Lucy load it?
No. Did she have it on flash drive or anything?
I don't.
They emailed it to us.
Okay, so we don't have
my
it.
Apologies.
There were slides available, so hopefully most of you have a copy of them.
Okay.
So by way of introduction, my name is Nancy Nelson. I'm a Vice President and Chief Actuary for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. Blue Cross is the largest health insurer in Minnesota. We serve about 2.6 million members, both in Minnesota and outside of Minnesota. Sure. We have been in business for 80 years, and we serve members in all 87 Minnesota counties. I've been working in the health actuarial field for quite a long time. And I have to say, I think you're pretty lucky today to have a demographer, a health services researcher, and an actuary talking to you, because we have all the really fun jobs with data. And if I had, had enough time to think about it ahead of time, it feels like we should be set up for a if I had a really good joke that we would all walk into, I don't know, a bar or the gates of in front of St. Peter, you know, the answer would sort of be like, okay, we're all getting older, the state's worried about it, and the actuary is going to make an assumption about next year. But I'm not quite sure where exactly the joke setup is. Anyway, my first slide that I have is actually similar to one of the slides that Mr. Gildemeister showed. This is a national view of where healthcare dollars go. And I guess I have the down arrows here. All right, so this, you know, it's similar to his. The, you know, brunt of spending is on hospital care, and that's both inpatient and outpatient, followed by physician and other professional care. And then another bucket of other. And the other is, as I looked up the definition that supports this national data, it's kind of a very much a catch-all. It includes things like ambulance services, dental care, school health services, worksite services, residential mental health and substance abuse, and kind of a catch-all. But, you know, probably, you know, could maybe they put it in as other as to opposed to having a whole bunch of little 2 and 3%ers. Drugs are also a significant cost, running at about 10%. And there's this source down here, which I would ask you all to put a star by it and go look at. This is an interactive set of graphs on national healthcare spending that's been prepared by the American Health Insurance Plans, which is a trade association representing health plans. But the slides are very well done, and they, you know, let you kind of scroll over and see changes year by year in spending and, you know, a variety of things. So they're quite interesting to look at. Another comment, seeing that I am representing a health plan here, is I want to make a comment that much of the spending on health is really on the dollars of care delivered to patients, or to, you know, we would call the people our members. You know, and most of those costs are really outside of the direct control of a health plan. On that same set of slides that I just referred to, published by the America's Health Insurance Plans, you know, estimates, you know, from 1960 to today, costs for the insurer side of things are somewhere in the typically 12 to 14% range, and that's expected to kind of continue. A little bit of a bump in the 2013 and 14 years, and that is probably largely due to the additional spending that's happening to bring up the requirements for the Affordable Care Act. And actually, I also want to point out that you should be aware, in Minnesota, the health plan costs tend to run a little bit lower as a percent of the premium paid, and that's probably, you know, may largely be a function that we are, for the most part, nonprofit entities in Minnesota. This slide is also similar to one that Mr. Gildemeister showed, trying to explain kind of the things that influence the cost of health care. And I'd ask you to look at the kind of the right-hand side of, you know, what healthcare costs are, and then working backwards to things that influence it. Total costs are influenced both by a unit cost, which is a, you know, a price per service, what, you know, we pay for each item that's presented to us for payment, and then the use of services. But the use of services is further broken down into, you know, how complicated somebody's illness is. That can change year over year per plan, and kind of the risk of the population. That's the box at the bottom that says illness severity and risk. And then the top is the unit price, which is the negotiated cost with a provider for a particular service. The complexity of services is then also influenced by where the service happens, whether it's in an inpatient setting, an outpatient setting, or office, or emergency room. It's also influenced by a provider practice pattern. You know, even within Minnesota, the practices of, you know, for example, low back care for, you know, whether somebody gets surgery or gets advised to do, you know, watchful waiting. There's a significant difference, you know, between regions and across states. And then another driver is just what the patient wants to do, because patients will have, you know, their own, you know, research, their own thoughts on what they want. They'll be, you know, make decisions in concert with their providers, but they can also influence, you know, where the service is received, and that might be just a function of where the patient lives. You know, if you need emergency care, you're going to go to the closest place. But it also might be, you know, a choice of, you know, just an example for me, you know, I have four sons. My preference is always a children's hospital with children's specialists and anesthesia and things like that. Someone else might be, you know, very comfortable with a situation that didn't have that additional level of service. So, you know, a variety of factors go into the cost. It's not just the negotiated rate between the insurer and the provider. This slide, I've got I think I have prettier colors than Stefan did, but it's exactly the same slide on the right-hand side of unit costs driving healthcare costs nationally. And the graph on the right is the exactly the same slide that Mr. Gildermeister showed. And you know, basically the turquoise bar is the piece that is the price. The red is the change in age and gender, and that's, you know, about 0.5% a year, so that's not, you know, insignificant as a cost driver. And the last piece is non-price, and largely I think of that as utilization or consumption of services, and, you know, generally that is less of a driver in the recent years. And that over time, over the years I've worked in this, that has had shifts from being a bigger driver relative to the unit cost, but currently the cost is the bigger driver of increases. That's interesting. I didn't realize this was a slide that built. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the other factors that drive the cost of healthcare, kind of within the context of that box of influencers. Inside of the provider and the provider network, we have the unit price paid for unit of service. We also have the choice of where services happen. And generally, there has been a pretty large shift over the last 10 to 15 years of services moving from an inpatient environment to an outpatient environment, which interestingly has the net effect of having the trend per service go up on both the inpatient and the outpatient side of things, if that makes sense. So the more complex things get shifted down to outpatient, meaning that's what's left on the inpatient side becomes more complex as well. And then again, I mentioned the choice of site of service of where someone chooses to get care. Drivers in the kind of the population side of things, we continue to see increased incidence of oncology and people needing treatment for cancers of various sorts, increased incidence of orthopedic procedures, and the probably ones that immediately come to mind are hips and knees, and the last being cardiovascular and related conditions or heart disease. Pharmacy costs also are a driver for us. Specialty costs, which really a very small number of members or patients receive, are increasing just at incredible rates. And these are the very complicated type of complex drugs that are typically administered by a physician, and they're sometimes even customized to a patient. So they have wonderful processes or wonderful potential to improve health status and outcomes, but they come at a very, very high cost. Another thing, for a number of years we had pharmacy costs basically held down because there were a number of very popular drugs that were transitioning from a brand status to a generic status as their patents wore off. Right now, we don't have any of those coming right in the future, so that will mean that drug costs will probably escalate more rapidly in the next few years than they have in the years before that. My next couple slides have to do with premiums rather than claims. We've mostly today been talking about the cost of medical services, but in my job, the big piece of my role is to basically set a price, which includes not just the claim costs, but the other pieces that go into it, what the benefits someone has are and what it costs us to administer things. So I want to talk a little bit about the additional things that impact premium trends. So that could be year-over-year changes in benefits. Employers sometimes will manage costs by changing benefits. So the underlying claim costs might be going up at the same rate, but the employer holds his own costs down by, say, reducing the benefits and shifting costs between the employer and his employees. Another kind of factor is age and gender. We've seen overall maybe 0.5% in the population, but for a particular employer, and particularly for small employers, the way their insurance is rated is typically a rate per person. So if an employer, say they're 25, they're 25 people and they drop the two, they drop five people who are 20 and they add five people who are 60, their rate's going to go up, a great deal. That really isn't a trend, but it certainly impacts the premium dollars out the door. Another consideration is the taxes that must be paid, and those can change year over year. Expenses can change, and those include the administrative costs for the health plan and also commission expenses and distribution costs. And then the out-of-pocket limits inside of a plan can also impact the premium trend. many, or in fact, most plans will have some kind of an out-of-pocket limit with, you know, say a deductible and then a 20% cost sharing and then a cap. If a plan retains that benefit feature year over year, that means, well, the total cost goes up to cover, the amount that the member is going to pay stays the same, which means that the increase on the piece paid by the health plan is basically leveraged upwards relative to the overall trend. Does that make sense to everybody? The concept is called leveraging trend, but it's a little bit confusing, but it's kind of a reason why your premium trend can be higher than the underlying claim trend. And conversely, admin trends often are lower than claim trends, which is quite depressing it the other way. My last slide, I want to talk a little bit about the impact that the Affordable Care Act has had on costs and premiums. Because, you know, a number of changes that have been added are, they're not really necessarily a medical trend cost, but they're going to affect the total cost of the premium. So some of those are new benefits. We now have much broader coverage of preventive services, no lifetime benefits, or no lifetime benefit maximums, and a standardized set of essential health benefits across the state. So to the extent those were not included in a contract, the, you know, renewal for the, you know, the product with those added in would be increased. You know, an example on the essential health benefits, in the individual market, it have products that don't cover substance abuse and mental health services have been, you know, quite popular, and people know a lot about themselves and whether they might choose to purchase that or not. But now all products must include that. So if someone had a product that didn't include that and now needs to cover it, that's a dramatic increase to the premium. We also now need to rate for a different population. With ACA, we have guaranteed issue of coverage and no pre-existing condition limitations. And, you know, we can argue whether those were good or bad, but they did do something to influence the, you know, the premium. So there's a, you know, a change in cost because of those. Cost sharing, in general, for many plans offered, the cost sharing limits are lower than what had been popular in the market. So that's contributed to increased premiums. There's a number of new taxes that need to be reflected, and those include the national insurer fee, the fees for the individual temporary reinsurance program, the state exchange fee, and then the fees to subsidize the outcomes research, which is the PCORI item there. We now have prescribed age factors, and in Minnesota that wasn't a really significant change because we had a 3-to-1 limit, and now we have a 3-to-1 limit with basically prescribed relationships. But nationally, where many plans had, or states had approved factors in a, you know, 5-to-1 or 6-to-1 relationship and allowed gender rating to be used, with a move to 3-to-1, that for certain persons has contributed to increases in rates. And then the last item related to ACA I want to talk about is the kind of actuarial value requirements. We refer to these as the metal levels, which is the bronze, silver, gold, and platinum plans. And basically, those plans have, we call them actuarial value, which is the relationship of, for an entire population, what the plan would pay relative to the total cost. And in many cases, even at a bronze level, which is a 60% payout, that's more generous than what had been available in the market. So to now have that minimum benefit level, there's the increase in the premium that goes with it. And I just felt that you know, cost trends and premium trends get, you know, they're very interrelated. I thought it was important to bring a little bit of premium information in as well. So I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you.
I think it is interesting to hear kind of what goes into our premiums. I think premium dollars often get equated with healthcare dollars, and it's a little bit more of a complex relationship than that. So are there any questions for Ms. Nelson's Representative Mason?
Madam Chair, Ms. Nelson, on the way in, I was listening to a radio program, and they were talking about the cost of drugs. And one of the callers called in. Somebody in her family had MS, and currently they're paying $84,000 a year for the medication. That has changed, and so this year they don't no longer have coverage, so where do they go? But one of the explanations about the cost of drugs in our country is the fact that at the national level we're prohibited from doing well, for like Medicare, et cetera, to do the gross negotiating, et cetera, that other countries are allowed. So,
you know, I think that that's true, and I believe what, you know, you're referring to is generally, I think the United States is the place where all development costs are passed on, and we're funding a lot of things, and we, in other states, they're countries are negotiating, you know, flat levels, and that kind of gets you to the stories of, you know, let's take a bus from the Twin Cities to Canada to buy drugs if you're a senior, because that's, you know, a way that they could be affordable. And, you know, that's a, I think, a really huge problem. I think, you know, drug costs are very high, and the example of, you know, $80,000, I mean, those aren't unheard of at all, and they're, it's a tiny piece of the population. It's that, you know, on the graph of the curve of how things are distributed, those are all people up in the upper, you know, 1%. So I guess I would agree with you, that's a huge concern, and I believe we have Prime Therapeutics, which is a pharmacy benefit manager, might have more, far more insight into that question, so maybe you'd post it to them as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you so much for being here today. And we did tee up our next presenter very well. And we'll hear from Tom Hoffman from Prime Therapeutics.
Well, thank you, Representative Halverson, Representative Mack, and everyone. I was trying to think about what would be, so I'm not an actuary, I'm not an economist, I'm not a demographer, so, you know, sort of, but I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night, or, and I think, you know, that joke is not so good, and so, I think what I'll tell you is that I am from Prime Therapeutics, a pharmacy benefit management company. I'll talk about what that is. I am an engineer by education. I have spent the last 2 years implementing the Affordable Care Act, but I sit within the marketing department of our company. So I'm just generally a confused guy trying to figure out my path forward. So I think that's really where I'm at. So let me see if I can find my presentation here. All right. And how do I... Here we go. Okay. So, there you go. All right, so I want to start by talking just a little bit about Prime, and again, what is a pharmacy benefit management or a PBM company? So, at a very high level, inside of every health plan, or the vast majority of health plans, and any health plan that's associated with the Affordable Care Act, there is a pharmacy benefit. And to most people, there really isn't any understanding of the difference between a pharmacy benefit and a medical benefit. And there certainly isn't any understanding that there's actually a different company administering that pharmacy benefit behind the scenes. But that is, in fact, the case, and that's what we do. And we do it on behalf of several large Blues plans around the country, one of them being Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota. So if you look at the slide here, you can just see a little bit about who we are. We are based here in Minnesota. We have a big operations center out in Eagan. Our headquarters is in Bloomington. We are owned by 13 not-for-profit blue plans around the country. That number is growing, and so that's good for us. We have 23 Blue Cross Blue Shield plan clients around the country, so 10 that are non-owners, but we still provide service. We have over 25 million members in our ranks. We have over 237 pharmacy claims that we pay annually, 65,000 retail pharmacies in our network, and over 7 million prescriptions that are shipped annually via our own pharmacy, our mail pharmacy, that we run and administer ourselves. Of the 3,200 employees around the country, over 2,000 of those are based here in Minnesota, and 600 of those are what I would call clinical employees, so pharmacy and pharmacy techs. So you can see on the map there kind of who we are, where our various locations are, where our footprint is around the country. So I want to talk a little bit about, again, what we do, and then get to quickly what are the cost drivers that we see coming. And Ms. Nelson hit on it just perfectly. There's really only one answer when you talk about what's driving costs today or what's driving costs up in the pharmacy world. It's specialty pharmacy, and I'll talk a little bit about what that means and why that is, and like anything, there's sort of good and bad aspects of that, and so I'll touch on that. First of all, our purpose statement, you can read it there, help people get the medicine they need to feel better and live well. And, you know, I think at even more sort of a broader scale or from a, what I'll call an economic scale, one of the things we work towards every day is to make sure that the pharmacy benefit is sustainable. We know that, like medical benefits and anything else, that if the cost gets beyond something that's just reasonably covered by a private employer or a health insurer or a state Medicaid system, that's something that just isn't sustainable. And we talk a lot about drug trends and cost trends, and we work every day to make sure that those trends are staying within sustainable levels. So I'll talk a little bit more about that as well. Just a little bit about the pharmacy benefit, some facts here. You know, we kind of get buried behind the medical benefit, but we are actually used 11 times more often than the medical benefit typically. We are typically the first medical, the first benefit touched. And if you look at some of the stats there, you'll see that pharmacy benefits are used in general up to 11 more times than a medical benefit. So I just finished implementing the Affordable Care Act on behalf of our company, and I, with regulators and legislatures and our clients and everybody else, I would state these facts over and over again, because really the pharmacy benefit is often what sets the tone for a medical plan at the start of a new year, and that's certainly been true with the Affordable Care Act. All right, some information here on trends now, and this is where we'll start talking about cost trends and specialty drugs and that sort of thing. What you see here is just kind of the factors driving drug trend. And first of all, just kind of a definition of what trend is. It's really the overall cost of prescriptions filled over a time, typically a year, relative to the prior year. So we look at trend, we try to keep it as low as possible, and even potentially have it go negative, because the more the trend is increasing and the more the trend is increasing faster than inflation, that's a problem. And that ultimately isn't something that will be sustainable. So we keep our eye on that very closely. And like I said, that's something we're focused on very heavily. The bubbles that you see there, or the circles you see kind of on the left side of the slide, are the things that are driving trend from a pharmacy perspective. The number of drugs that are used, just so overall utilization across the board, the cost of those drugs, traditional drugs are staying flat relatively, but we're approaching what we call the generic cliff, which is we're running out of generics to convert brand costs to generic costs at a much lower cost. We're just running out of those, and I think Ms. Nelson mentioned that as well. And then the mix of drugs. One of the things I'll talk about is the mix of drugs is trending towards more expensive drugs and specialty drugs, and that's driving our trend as well. All right, so here's what drug trend has looked like for the past 32 years. And you'll see it's kind of a mixed bag. It somewhat follows the economy. Unfortunately, we feel that we're in the up end of a downward swing. So last couple of years have been a downward swing for a number of reasons, the economy being a big one. But like I talked about, we've got a number of dynamics in play in our industry that are potentially going to be driving the trend up in the coming years. And so I'll talk about what those are as we go. So talking about kind of the three components I mentioned earlier that are driving trend, and talking about what happened to those in 2012. So utilization was up 0.7%, which is actually pretty good. Inflation was up 6.4%. That's higher than general inflation, so that's a number that's not so good. And generic use was offset some of these costs by about 4.6%. So that's a very positive thing. So the overall drug trend for 2012, there's a couple other factors that come into play here, but the overall drug trend we saw for 2012 was 2.1%. So again, I'll tell you what that means. The overall cost of the prescription drug benefit that we provided to our members on behalf of our Blue Cross Blue Shield clients for 2012 was 2.1% higher than it was the year prior. And again, that's a number that we focus on very closely year to year. All right, the generic cliff. So there's a lot of study that says sort of the highest generic penetration possible is about 85%. So, and I'll talk about what generic means, just in case there's someone who is in the room is not sure. So if you think about a brand drug, let's say Lipitor, the way the pharma industry works in our country, a pharma company invents a drug. It's subject to patent for, I think, 7 years before generic drugs can be created at a much lower cost. And as we reach those seven-year milestones, generic drugs become available for, say, Lipitor, and then those are offered to our members and most health plan members across the country at a much lower cost and effectively do the exact same thing. And so over the past several years, we've had several high-cost drugs that have converted to generics year over year and have ultimately driven down the cost of the pharmacy benefit. We are, however, approaching the end of that cycle. I pulled some data here when I was preparing for my presentation. We are at a 78% generic penetration today. So you can see we're very close to what many consider the limit of 85%. And so there just aren't a lot of high-cost drugs in the pipeline that will be converting to generic soon. And so we are approaching what we consider the generic cliff, which will be one of the things that drives up cost over time. All right, a little bit about specialty. And a little bit first about what specialty drugs are. So Ms. Nelson touched on it a little bit. They're very complex, high-cost drugs that are treating often very complex conditions. So often oncology drugs, MS drugs, growth hormone is another one. Often treating a very small population, but in many cases a very acute or very chronic population. And as we talked about, the outcomes from specialty drugs are often very, very positive. I mean, who could argue the benefits of an improved oncology drug that maybe extends the life of a cancer patient or maybe puts someone into remission? That is the reality of specialty drugs. They are helping a small population, but it's a population that is in desperate need in many cases of help. And unfortunately, the help comes at a very high cost. And that, in a nutshell, is what a specialty drug is. You can see the graphic there on the slide. The amount of specialty drugs on the market has exploded in the last 20 years. And again, there's a lot of different perspectives on whether or not that's a good or bad thing. If you look at it from purely a cost perspective, it is something that's a significant driver. And I'll just call your attention again to the 40% there. Of all the drugs in the pipeline, 40% of them being developed are specialty drugs. And on this slide, we just kind of paint the picture of what the cost per volume is of specialty drugs versus traditional. I think I've already kind of touched on this, but again, it's sort of a low volume number of drugs that are driving a very high cost compared to traditional costs that are, you know, sort of widely used, but are available at a much lower cost in often cases in a generic form. So we can already see the effect of specialty drugs on our overall drug trend. And if you can kind of decipher that graphic there, you'll see that our drug trend in 2001, as I mentioned, was 2012 was 2.1%. 19.1% was the specialty drug trend for 2012. So if we took out the specialty cost from our overall trend in 2012, we would have had a negative trend. So you can see that specialty, even though it's still a low volume, it's becoming more and more of a significant percent of our overall cost, and that trend continues to go up. So what can we do about this? Well, there's no magic answers. Care coordination is just sort of a general term for some of the tools that we put in place that really help make sure that drugs are being administered in the most effective way, in the most cost-effective setting, and via the most cost-effective channel. So sometimes if you think about an oncology patient, for example, oftentimes oncology is delivered at a clinic. There's certain oncology drugs that can be administered at home. That's something that is typically favorable and preferred by the patient. It is at a lower cost, and it is an opportunity that really represents a win-win across the board. And so we have programs in place where we look at claims, we look at prescriptions as they're coming in, and we look at what other options are there in order to effectively deliver drugs and get people, again, the drugs they need, but in the most cost-effective setting. So you can kind of see in the bullet circles there sort of many components of our care coordination programs. All right, another one I want to talk about is narrow networks, and this tends to be a little bit of a complicated and I'll say even controversial topic. And the first thing I want to say is that a narrow pharmacy network is not the same as a narrow medical network. And before we kind of get into the details, I want to talk about what a network is. I think most people know, but just to make sure we're all on the same page, one of the values a PBM brings to sort of the medical and healthcare industry is the ability to negotiate drug costs. And we do that typically by negotiating directly with retail pharmacies. And one of the things that happens is if we can narrow the network, in other words, go more exclusively with a particular retail pharmacy, it often allows us to lower the cost of drugs via negotiation. So there's no magic in the equation. If we can drive more volume to a particular retail pharmacy, we're likely going to be able to get a better cost. And so that is, in a nutshell, what a narrow network will do. And so one of the things we're always looking at, is there an opportunity to provide a narrow network option to a health plan while still providing our members appropriate access to a pharmacy within, you know, a certain radius of their home, doing it in a way that doesn't disrupt any pharmacist-patient relationships. Those are not nearly as prevalent and important typically as they are on the medical side, but it is something that we look at very, very closely. And I will say that I think narrow networks and what I'll call narrow drug lists, in other words, really focusing exclusively on generics where they're available, that is a significant lever that a pharmacy benefit management can and has pulled to some extent already to lower drug trend. But there are still opportunities to sort of pull this lever farther. And we're always trying to find the right balance of narrowing that network, narrowing that drug list, while still providing our members the appropriate access that they need. All right, and finally I'll just talk about benefit design. This is my last slide. And we touched on this a little bit in the previous presentation. One of the things we do is try to make sure, first of all, our pharmacy benefit aligns with our medical, the medical benefit that we're supporting. There's lots of data out there that says if the benefit is too complex, members just don't understand it and they just go to the doctor. And oftentimes when people just go to the doctor without thinking about what their benefit is or without thinking about what's the most appropriate place for care, that drives cost up. And so one of the things is we always try to create a plan design that's simple to understand but drives the behavior that's most cost-effective and appropriate for our members. So from a pharmacy perspective, you might see co-pays that are in the $5 to $10 range for people who are using generic drugs. For preferred brand drugs, that might go up to $35, for example, when a generic option is available. And for non-preferred brands, in other words, those would be brands that there is no negotiated price, the cost might be higher. And then you can see where we get into specialty drugs. Again, these are drugs that may cost hundreds of thousands of dollars per member per year. The cost sharing associated with those drugs might be $85 to $150 at a preferred level, and then at a non-preferred level up to 20% of the cost of the drug, typically with some sort of maximum, for example, $250. All right, so that's all I have. Any questions for me?
I'll ask a brief question. And keeping in mind that we have a time crunch, sure. So I'll ask this question, and maybe we can connect offline, or somebody else in the room can connect offline. And I'll probably be very clumsy in framing this up. But as I look at the growth in specialty drugs, I
and the also the push to get patients more involved in sharing costs and sharing decision making in their health care. Is there work that's going on that's helping patients who, if they're taking these specialty drugs, they're probably in a very severe health situation, and is there resources available for patients to help them make decisions with their doctor? And I guess I'm thinking about sort of a personal example where I have had a family member who had cancer and decided that the life extension that chemo would give him was not going to be worth the cure, if you will, was not going to be worth the pain and sure. the additional impacts to the health and quality of life. Even right. though it was going to be a longer life, the quality of life choice was part of that equation. And as we see the growth in these kinds of specialty drugs, are there resources for folks to have those conversations and learn more about those?
Yeah, and I'll try to just answer briefly. You know, as part of our care management program, sort of that circle of we do have, you know, outreach to members. We do have support services. You know, a very specific discussion around, you know, chemo or not and life expectancy, we would probably refer someone to, you know, maybe even their doctor or some sort of counselor for that sort of decision. But in talking about, you know, things like, do I want to have this drug administered at home or a clinic? What are the trade-offs? What are the pros and cons? We do have clinicians available, and we can make outreach, and we do make outreach. Kind of all depends on the plan design. Or if it's something that's, you know, just sort of out of our league to answer, we can make referrals elsewhere.
Thanks. Other questions? Yeah, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In light of the previous testifier with regard to the ACA and now with no lifetime maximums, provision that is on the middle class of benefits, what would you conclude then, and this is trying not to be rhetorical, but what would you conclude the outcome being with specialty drugs in the mix with that hockey stick curve in terms of consumption patterns for care, as we right now are dealing with an actuarial life table that goes out to 105.
Right.
What conclusions would
you
draw?
Yeah, you know, I mean, if I wish I had a magic ball to say that. I mean, to know that. I think ultimately, no lifetime max will ultimately be a cost driver in our industry over time and will potentially over time have an impact on premiums. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. If the underlying costs go up and you believe in, an industry that will cover the costs via premium, whether it's a premium paid by the government or a premium paid by a private employer or paid by an individual or some combination of that, there's no question that will have an impact on premium. I don't think there's any way around it.
No, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for being here, Mr. Hoffman. Very interesting. And finally, we get to hear from Craig Akam, the Chief Operating Officer from ICSI. Thank you so much. And now we get to, we're shifting a little bit from trends onto care models. So welcome, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs, for the invitation to come and talk about our work. Given the time, we'll try to be quick. Fortunately, I would say the state demographer, the state health economist, and all the folks from Blue Cross and Prime Therapeutics probably took all the best slides, so we'll be able to gloss through ours rather quickly. So for the record, my name is Craig Akam. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, otherwise known as ICSI for short. That's a mouthful to say. And ICSI is and has been for the last 20 years an independent nonprofit collaborative bringing together payers, providers, purchasers, and citizens to help improve health and healthcare here in Minnesota. And so with me is Dr. Howard Epstein, our Chief Health Systems Officer. Dr. Epstein is going to walk through a quick presentation to talk a little bit about some of the issues and initiatives that ICSI has been working on, and we'd be happy to answer any questions at the end.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Craig. And sometimes the difficult portion of going last on an agenda is everybody's stolen your thunder. In this case, I think it'll save us some time, so I'll get right to it. So as Craig mentioned, we are a health improvement collaborative comprised of over 50 member organizations, health plan sponsors. This comprises over 9,000 doctors in the state of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So we have quite a broad impact across the entire region when we do implementation efforts. I'm here to talk more conceptually and hopefully offer more of an optimistic picture that there's maybe some light at the end of the tunnel and it's not just a train approaching. So I want to talk a little bit about the conceptual notion of the triple aim of health. And I think we've already heard about the financial pressures and impacts not only to healthcare but the other segments of our economy by the increased costs of healthcare delivery system. The notion of the triple aim, which if you have not heard of before, was introduced by Dr. Don Berwick, who was the former CMS administrator, who said that in order to really change the dynamic that we're stuck in right now, that we need to do three things simultaneously, three separate aims. One is actually focus on improving the health of the population, not the health care, but the health of the population. Enhance the patient experience of care, which includes quality, access, and reliability, as well as safety. And then, of course, to reduce or at least control the per capita costs of care. Okay. So you've already seen this slide from Mr. Gildemeister. I don't have to review it again, but I think I'll just call out that although the overall growth in the trend of healthcare spending has decreased and leveled off over the last decade, and we talked about specific drivers that might be causing that, the absolute costs are still going up. It's just not rising as quickly as it had been. You've already seen this slide as well from Ms. Brower. And this is really central to the conundrum that we're in, or a term that we use is a polarity that we need to manage. That is that the demographics and the complexity of care and the pressures on healthcare spending, especially from a state budgetary standpoint, continue to grow and are outstripping revenue streams to support that and at the cost of all other potential investments. Where that really impacts us in the production of the health of our population is that only 20% of the health of our population is actually produced by the healthcare delivery system. This was something that was really an eye-opener for me when I really started delving into population health management. The bulk of what makes us better, healthier, more productive citizens is the other physical environment, the quality of our air and water, sanitation, socioeconomic factors, whether we're gainfully employed, highly educated, skillful workers with stable incomes and family and social support systems, and living in safe neighborhoods, that we don't have too many healthy or unhealthy or risky health behaviors, such as tobacco use, poor diet, lack of exercise, excessive and unsafe and risky alcohol use, unsafe sex practices. Those are the things that really determine the health of the population. So we're stuck in this conundrum where we're spending so much money in that 20% on the health of the population when our real bang for the buck is in the social determinants, the upstream impacts that we can invest in. But we don't have the money to invest in because we're spending it on the left side of that graph. So from a population health management standpoint, this is I think, one way to look at this, and I'll call this out. But on the left-hand side, you have generally younger, healthier people. They may have some unhealthy practices, behaviors, some health risks that could be genetic or familially inherited, but there are things that could be managed. And so our job is to keep the people on moving and staying on the left-hand side of that population spectrum. On the right-hand side, you have the people that we've heard about, the 1% that impacts 20% of our healthcare spend and 5%, which is half of our healthcare spend. On the right-hand side, people with either acute or complex catastrophic cases, people with single significant or multiple chronic conditions, complex cases, and all the way on the right-hand side of the spectrum of the continuum of healthcare are people approaching or at end-of-life care. that could benefit from palliative and or hospice services to help them through that transition and to support them as well as their families through that. So this is how we think about population health. And although you know what you heard this morning was absolutely correct, and that we need to look for, as Willie Sutton said, you know, I rob banks because that's where the money is. You know, we tend to look right away at the right hand side of the spectrum because that's where the most money is being spent. But there's a lot of debate as to actually how much of that cost is really impactable. I think we need to approach those impactable cases and manage them as best as possible, wherever possible. But we can't forget that not just looking 1 year ahead, but if you're developing policy 5, 10, 20 years down the road to manage the health of our population, if we lose sight of managing the left-hand side of that graph, then we're going to be even a worse place than we are now. We've already heard about from Mr. Gildemeister about the waste in the healthcare system, and I quoted the 2011 Institute of Medicine report estimating that 30% of all of our healthcare spending is non-value-added spending. So it doesn't actually improve the health or outcomes of our population, doesn't make us healthier or more productive. And so for the United States, in 2009 terms, we spent $2.5 trillion. And $765 billion of that, $750 billion, did not improve the health of our population. And it further goes on to categorize this into six buckets where we could start to address this non-value-added care. We've already heard about excessive administrative costs and pricing failures, as well as missed prevention opportunities, again, the left-hand side of that continuum of care, but also the inefficient delivery of services, poor care coordination, communication between different silos of the healthcare, hospital, clinic, different systems not being able to communicate with each other and sharing of electronic records. Fraud and abuse is a component of that, but a large part of that is unnecessary services, tests, procedures, treatments that we know through evidence doesn't improve the health of individual patients or the health of the population. And at best, we're wasting money, but at worst, we're actually harming people by doing tests and procedures that raise other questions that patients don't have. They don't present with symptoms that probably in the large scheme of things, most people would never be impacted by those things. But once we start imaging and finding things, then as a physician, I have to start doing something about it. So that contributes as well. And I want to make sure that we understand that what we're really talking about is appropriate use of healthcare services. And just as we're talking a lot about the overuse and about healthcare services, We can't lose sight of the left-hand side, which is the underuse of, again, prevention, risk management, and keeping people healthy and well. Another way to look at this is that we have a current state where we have a lot of non-value-added care. We're spending a lot of money that doesn't improve health. And the actual healthcare system is fraught with errors that potentially harm people. Potentially preventable events like readmissions that you heard of, but also admissions, especially for what we call ambulatory sensitive conditions like asthma and diabetes, that if we just manage it better on the outpatient side, patients wouldn't have to go to the emergency department or were admitted to the hospital. I'll talk more about unnecessary treatments and then inefficiencies in the healthcare system. And if you can start to eliminate that orange bucket, and really focuses on the services that add value to health, and some of those are things that are not reimbursed under the current fee-for-service model. If we can redesign our healthcare delivery system and our payment system to actually invest in those health-producing services, then we can reach a future state where most, if not all, of the care that we actually deliver is producing better health, total value. Now, this is my requisite busy slide, and I'm not going to go through that graph, but I just want to call attention to one of the initiatives that ICSI as a health improvement collaborative in combination with our members that I mentioned before, health plan sponsors and other stakeholders, were able to accomplish by sitting down at a table and coming up with some big solutions to some big problems. So what I'll point out in the graph here is that yellow line and the red line. The red line is before we started our high-tech diagnostic imaging initiative, which addresses the appropriate use of CAT scans, PET scans, MRI scans, to just providing those services when they are evidence-based, that we could bend the cost trend that we heard about earlier. And that's, in fact, what we were able to accomplish by visualization of the yellow line. That's nearly flat. So the key outcomes of this multi-year initiative, which used decision support, actual rules and guidelines that not only could be used at the on the provider end when they're ordering these tests and procedures, but can be used in that shared decision-making process that was mentioned earlier with patients. Just turn that computer screen around and show that, oh, there's a red light here, that this is clearly not indicated. But there's a yellow light. We need to have more of a conversation about how this really is going to benefit you and the unintended harms that we need to consider. And green light, which just says, yeah, this is clearly indicated. Let's just go ahead and order that. And by using that kind of a system, it decreased the administrative complexity. There was no prior authorization process on the back end that is expensive and costly and burdensome to not only the providers but also the health plans and having to administer those benefits. And by doing so, we were able to show that there was a 10% increase in adherence to best practices, that growth trend that was a 7% to 8% year-over-year increase in the use of those services pretty much flattened out to 1% over the entire six-year period of that intervention. And by doing so, there was an estimated savings to Minnesota over that period of over $200 million, and $150 million of that we estimate is directly attributable to the specific program. And because unnecessary radiation that we use in CAT scans and so forth, we were able to prevent 96 future cases of cancer here in Minnesota, and the costs and not only in financial terms but human terms associated with that. So that's one example of what we can do when we come together as a collaborative. A more recent example is our RARE campaign. It's called Reducing Admissions, Reducing Avoidable Readmissions Effectively. This is a campaign with multiple organizations partnering, leading the charge. So ICSI, in combination with Stratus Healthcare, our quality improvement organization here in Minnesota, as well as the Minnesota Hospital Association, in combination with community partners and other partners throughout Minnesota, we're able to really achieve triple aim improvement. So by doing basic interventions, and there's a seminal study published in the New England Journal in 2009 that said that 20% of all Medicare beneficiaries that were admitted to the hospital were readmitted within 30 days. One out of every five patients was admitted within 30 days, and fully half of those didn't even get to see their physician or care provider on the outside before they returned to the hospital. So through specific interventions, and I'd be happy to share those with you at another time, 83 hospitals now are currently part of this campaign, and by doing this, we've blown through our initial targets of reducing avoidable hospital readmissions of 4,000, which translates to 16,000 nights of actually sleeping in your own home, or if you're in that sandwich generation, not worrying about your kid or your parent, being in the hospital and losing time from work, and by doing so, save tens of millions of dollars. So, in fact, this number that I have on the slide is already outdated, and through the third quarter of last year, we now have prevented over 7,000 avoidable readmissions, and that equates to over 28,000 nights sleeping at home instead of in the hospital setting. And if you're good at doing math, that's almost 78 years of people not being in the hospital. And as a result of doing so, we conservatively estimate that this has already reached $60 million of avoided healthcare spending in Minnesota. And this campaign was recently recognized through a national award, the John M. Eisenberg Award, presented jointly by the Joint Commission for Hospital Accreditation and the National Quality Forum, a leading healthcare organization in the country, for the work that we've done here collaboratively here in Minnesota. So we're quite proud of that and happy to share that with you, Madam Chair. I think the last thing I want to mention in this vein and in the next progression is something called the Choosing Wisely campaign. And I say so because I have a feeling that a lot of people have not yet heard about this, but you will. There have been public service announcements running on television and radio stations across Minnesota. But briefly, the Choosing Wisely campaign is an initiative of the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation, partnering with Consumer Reports and dozens of medical specialty societies at the national level. And it's very basic. They say that they've committed to 5 tests and procedures within those provider practices that we do all the time that are not evidence-based, that don't improve the health of our patients, best waste money and resources, and at worst we're actually harming our patients. There are now almost 250 recommendations. So it's now become the norm for providers to engage in these conversations with patients, and there's a whole separate arm actually through Consumer Reports, especially with lots of consumer-related information to start questioning a lot of the care that's provided and saying, is this really going to help me? What happens if is there another option? What if I don't do anything? How much is this going to cost me? And what are the side effects? So this is, an opportunity for us to really engage our entire community in what is appropriate care, that slide that I showed earlier. So there's lots more that I could have talked about. I would encourage you to go to our website at ICSI.org, lots of our healthcare initiatives, and there's really a fantastic video developed by David Gillette and produced by Twin Cities Public Television. I encourage you to look at that, more Choosing Wisely here, and I'll stop there and entertain, along with Mr. Acom, any questions you might have, or just stop for time's sake. So thank you very much.
Well,
so
I really appreciate you being here and hanging in there, because we, like I said, we're squeezing 3 meetings into 2, so we're running a little long, but I think that this tees up the next phase of our conversations very well, and you made the point that we're just starting to scratch the surface. This is the beginning of a conversation, mm-hmm. and so I have no doubt that we'll continue to look to you as resources in terms of knowledge and understanding what kind of work is happening. Mm-hmm. So are there any questions for this particular? Yeah.
I was just, thank you. I was just curious, and maybe you had said some of these slides, are they on your website, or if we wanted, do you have these available to add to our collection of paper here?
And actually, Madam Co-Chair, I apologize that the committee didn't have paper copies of the presentation. We will certainly make that available to the committee shortly. But there, all of this information, maybe not in this particular slide deck, is available on our website, including additional information that I think the committee might find of interest.
Very helpful. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you for being here today. And for everybody else, we're going to come back on February 11th, and we will be hearing from groups to carry on this discussion about care models that are starting to emerge in Minnesota. And with that, I think we can adjourn. All right.
Thank you.